At that time, she fell down at the feet of Lord Krishna with tears in her eyes.
Perfect.
Queen Draupadi had a beautiful bunch of hair, which was sanctified in the ceremonial function of Rajasriya Yajna. But when she was lost in a bed, Yudhishthira touched her glorified hair to insult her. Draupadi then fell down at the lowest feet of Lord Krishna, and Lord Krishna decided that all the wives of Yudhishthira and company should have their hair loosened as a result of the battle of Kurukshetra. Thus, after the battle of Kurukshetra, after all the sons and grandsons of Dhritarashtra died in battle, all the wives of the family were obliged to loosen their hair as widows. In other words, all the wives of the Kuru family became widows because of Yudhishthira's insulting great devotee of the Lord. The Lord can tolerate insults upon himself by any miscreant, because the Father tolerates even insults from the Son. But he never tolerates insults upon his devotees. By insulting a great soul, one has to forego all the results of pious acts and benediction also. Om again, Chimana Pasyatya, and Dila Asana Paya, Chachin Pratikapiyena, says my Sri Rube Maha. It is he only who loosened the hair of all the wives of the miscreants. Who is that he? That is Krishna. Krishna, in his role of time, killed all those who were opposed to Dharma or religious, the eternal occupation of living entity, which is to render service to Krishna. Those of you who have read Bhagavad Gita, you know Arjuna was protesting, why should I fight against family, friends, and my teachers? And in the 11th chapter of the Gita, the Lord reveals his universal form, in which you could see all the events of the cosmos happening within this form. In other words, time has form. This is something we usually don't think about. Kala Rupa. Time has form. The shape of events, we say in our ordinary lingo. Indeed, the events actually have shape. And that shape is the universal form of the Lord. So, Krishna revealed that Kala Rupa, or universal form, to Arjuna. But it wasn't really Arjuna's predilection to see that form. Arjuna was attached to Krishna in his two-handed form. But the Lord wanted to show Arjuna how all the events that would happen at the battle, they were going to happen, regardless of Arjuna's state of mind. In the universal form, Krishna showed Arjuna how all the soldiers and great generals were going to die. Why? Because of their unlawful acts, all the Kauravas, they would die. These things were hanging over their head. The future was guaranteed because of their unlawful acts. This is something that is missing today completely in so-called civilization. People have no conception that their reactions are hanging over their head. The people think that you can talk to them at university, anywhere, that, well, I'm just acting, and like acting in a vacuum. And I'll just learn, or not learn, as I see fit, and that's all there is to take into account. In other words, the people do not understand their real environment. They talk about ecology, but they don't know the components of their environment. The environment is not simply composed of your actions, is also composed of your reactions. So if you're really going to be holistic and see the true ecological picture, you've got to see the reactions to your actions. And everyone is blind to that today. They just think, oh, just have a good desire in your heart and just do what you got to do to be happy and it'll all work out. What else can you do? What other standard can we expect for life? This is why I hear again and again and again. What else can you do? There's nothing better than that. There won't be anything better than that. And so, if there is a next life, well, you know, if you're having a good feeling in your heart, all the best will come to you, whatever is there. No. You need to see the true picture. And in the universal form, presented in the 11th chapter of the Gita, Arjuna is able to see how it all fits together, actions and reactions. Those who perform unlawful acts, they'll die in the battle of Kurukshetra. They're getting their reaction to their unlawful acts. And what was one of those unlawful acts? Insulting Draupadi, someone else's wife. Now, you hear in the purport, and those of you who know Mahabharata, you know how Draupadi was lost in a gambling match between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. Kshatriyas, warrior princes, are allowed to gamble. They cannot refuse a challenge. They're not allowed to refuse a challenge. The problem was that the gambling was fixed. It was rigged. And in this rigged gambling match, the Pandavas lost their wife. So what did the Kauravas do? Oh, they were, some of them especially, were lusting after Draupadi ever since she became the wife of Arjuna. They maintained a deep attachment for her. So as soon as Draupadi was won by them in the gambling match, immediately they said, let's disrobe her in the midst of this public assembly. The gambling match was held in a grand arena. And so, what did they do? Draupadi is ours. You've lost her in your life. She's now our property. Let us disrobe her. In native civilization, this is in current so-called civilization, this is a daily event. Because they're quite honorable. Oh. I have to confess, when I was about 16 years old, I went to visit my father. He had remarried, and I was living with him for a few months. And in his bedroom, he had a picture of his wife with no coverings. So I was watching him take his mates back into the room and. Yeah, like a pride, you know. I was totally shocked by it. But, you know, he was felt great honor. And of course, I was watching his friend. There, my wife. So, this is the age of coming in which people had no sense of decorum. Therefore, it seems a little shocking why one reason for an immense battle is that someone's life was insulted. According to Vedic culture, if someone tries to even entice your wife, what to speak of kidnapper, that person is considered an aggressor. If someone tries to administer poison to your family, burn down your house, steal your agricultural crops, entice your wife or kidnap her, those persons are classified as aggressors, and you can take appropriate action, even to the point of ending their life. So this is what happened to Draupadi. They tried to disrobe her, and it was a hopeless event. These great generals pulling at the sari of a woman. And she tried to protect herself, but finally she realized materially it's impossible. And she quit trying to hold on to her sari. She raised both hands in the air and called out to Krishna. And as most of you know, Krishna made it so that her sari would have no end. So these great generals are pulling, and they've got a huge pile of cloth, and still she's not disrobed. Finally, they just gave up. But in the process, they insulted her by touching her hair. In Vedic culture, everything has significance. The details are important. The way a woman wears her hair in Vedic culture signifies whether she's married, unmarried, or even a prostitute, just by the way she wears her hair. Now, Draupadi's hair was very sanctified due to yajna, due to a great sacrifice. So her hair was especially noted. Now, in Vedic civilization, actually, the only one who sees a woman with her hair down completely is her husband. So everything has a reason. for guaranteeing purity, for guaranteeing integrity. It's not like it's just some kind of blind application of Islamic law. People are very afraid of that. You know, Iran, Afghanistan, you know, the women must wear shrouds or, you know, they must, you know, people are very afraid of that. They should understand the reasons for these Vedic items. The whole point is to bring about the chance for real happiness, which can't happen if there is uncontrolled sense behavior and a lack of proper procedure and behavior. The whole point of Vedic culture is how to act so that you don't incur contamination. So, it's not like the women were feeling repressed that they could only let their hair down before their husband and they didn't expose themselves in public. Prabhupada describes India at the beginning of the 20th century that even if a respectable woman was going across the street to visit a neighbor, she would ride in a palanquin. You know, a palanquin is these kind of mobile compartments, and two men would carry the front, two men would carry the back. I guess you've seen it in movies or something. So, just to go across the street, she would not be seen. She wouldn't allow herself to be seen by the ordinary people. She would get into the palanquin at her door, they would lift it up and carry it across the street so she could visit her neighbor, and then she would get out and go into the house. So he might say, oh, what a pain in the neck. Did you see yourself doing that? And Ronnie's going to work in a shop and now I get out, you know. So now the neighbors here, you know. Now, we think this is a very great inconvenience. And certainly, the way things are today, we didn't apply these types of measures. The understanding is lost, the whole proper context is lost, so don't worry. But at the same time, though, we should appreciate the purpose behind all that. It's not repression, it's not enslavement, it is liberation. That's the point. How male and female can act so they don't drag each other down, but they actually elevate one another. That's the purpose behind it all, how to cut down contamination. But no one worries about that these days. So, it was a great insult that they touched Drogi's hair with the speaker, this Drogi. And later, what happened? After the Battle of Kurukshetra, Kakali was finished. Ashvatthama, who's the son of Dronacharya, the military teacher of both the Pandavas and the Kauravas, Ashvatthama killed Draupadi's five babies in their sleep. Horrible. He thought that would satisfy his master, Duryodhana. The five sleeping young children. So Yoga Maya, just imagine she had five children and there's, you know, the age of Draupadi, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, 6 years old, and they're all sleeping, and someone comes and cuts off their head. So that happened to Draupadi. Done by this warrior who thought that he would get honored by doing that. He's from the opposing side. Now invading warfare, there's no question of killing women. There's no question of killing children. You can't even kill a warrior if you got his back turned to you or was unarmed. So this was a horrible thing to my Ashvatthama. So Ashvatthama brought the five heads to his master, Duryodhana, who was about to die on the battlefield with a broken spine from Bhima's club. And instead of Duryodhana being pleased, of course, he was shocked at such a heinous act. Even Duryodhana was shocked. Oh, this is just too much. Then what happened when Draupadi's husband Arjuna found out about this? Oh, you can imagine how enraged he was, especially being a warrior. Arjuna told the grieving Draupadi that, don't worry, I'll wipe I'll wipe away the tears from your eyes after I catch him. In other words, by my apprehending this culprit, then I'll be entitled to wipe the tears from your eyes. I'll let you reflect. And after you perform the funeral ceremony for your dead sons, you'll be able to take your bath standing on this aggressor's head. In other words, I'm going to cut his head off. When you take your bath, you can stand on it.
So you might say, oh, this is a...
But that is proper. It's not that you, in the name of nonviolence, you allow someone to kill your wife, kill your children, especially Arjuna, who's a warrior. It's not only, it's his job not only to defend his family, but to defend others who are not warriors. So certainly he was entitled to react in that way. He was giving protection. He was giving proper protection to his wife. It was obvious, right? You can't conceive of the grief of having your five babies slaughtered in the night beheaded. So Arjuna said like that, you'll be able to take your bath standing on his beheaded head. So then he chased after this abominable rascal. And that's another description, the story of the chase and the apprehension. So Arjuna apprehended this Ashwatthama, bound him like an animal, and brought him before his wife. I've got him. Just see. Now, what are we going to do with him? But Draupadi became very compassionate. Krishna was also there, and Krishna was saying, he's an aggressor, he must be killed. So there Ashwatthama bound like an animal in front of Draupadi, and he had just killed her five sleeping babies. Krishna's also there, Arjuna's there. What is Draupadi's response? Sometimes you have these dramas in modern courtrooms where there's a killer of someone's daughter or son or relative, and the whole family goes to court, you know. And, you don't have the death penalty in New Zealand, but in the USA, in most states, they have the death penalty. So the whole family of the victim goes to court, you know, hang him, gas him, burn him, kill him. Yeah. And the judge is trying to keep order in the court, the due process of law has to go on, and the family is, giving all sorts of emotional reactions, and the accused killer is, at the front of the courtroom being interrogated, and the whole family is glaring at him from the audience. They had the newspaper reporters waiting outside to interview the family, and the family's always saying things like, I'll only be satisfied when he gets the same thing as my murdered daughter. But sometimes they even say, she's gone, there's nothing that can be done about it. We don't really care what happens to him. And most of the time, though, it's, we want him to get his. And if there's some kind of verdict which is not as severe as the family expects, then they complain to the newspapers, oh, what a miscarriage of justice. How can this go on? I saw this recently in New Zealand, North Island. These home invaders, they killed a man's wife, a farmer's wife. I think you probably saw it. And then it went to court, and of course the family members are waiting there, making sure that justice is given. You don't have the dead family here, but they wanted a severe sentence. So here is this killer of five babies. Without a doubt, he's the killer of five sleeping children. And he's been apprehended by the husband, as he promised. And he's brought before the wife. Now, what would you do? What would you think? In this way, you can begin to understand the qualities of Krishna's devotees. Draupadi's first reaction was, actually, he's a Brahmana. We can't treat him like this. He's the son of a spiritual intellectual and should be treated in that way. What kind of culture is this, as he would say to them? The first thing, why is he bound like this? He's actually a Brahmana, and we worship the Brahmanas, we revere the Brahmanas, they're the head of the society. She was taking it in that way, in the way of social customs, that He's our superior. The Brahmins are meant to advise everyone. Why is he bound? That was their first reaction. Astounding how much sense control was there. The murder of your five sleeping children, and he's brought before you captured, and you said, but what about his social rank? This, despite Arjuna's hesitation to fight in the battle of Kurukshetra, shows great character and sense control, even though actually he was wrong. Krishna wanted him to fight. It was proper that he fight. Still, his hesitation and his deliberation why he shouldn't fight shows great strength of character. You see, our tendency is immediately, either this way or that way. But to actually control yourself and see all sides of an issue, and then, after much deliberation, try to come to a conclusion that is satisfactory, that is great sense control and restraint, which doesn't exist in the culture today. Today, just do something immediately. And with that immediate instant expression, you justify yourself as a person. I immediately responded like this. Everybody preaches, yes, very good, but you responded like that. But in Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, we see the great souls exercising great restraint and display of inner fortitude and character. So Draupadi, she's no yogi, she's no brahmana, but she is showing the character of devotion. In other words, more important than my feelings about my murdered sons is that he is a brahmana, the highest level of society. She's thinking of society, she's thinking of dharma, she's thinking of religious principles, not her own personal situation. It's amazing. Yes, he's killed my five sleeping sons, but he's a brahmana. He's from the topmost sector of society, those are supposed to be giving spiritual instruction. Why is he bound like this? Immediately you see her lack of self-centeredness. Immediately you see her consideration of what is good for society, according to her view. There'll be complications of that later, but still, she's thinking like that in such a selfless way. In other words, she doesn't become caught up. Now, immediately, she's self-controlled and very precise. What else does she say besides, why is he now? He's the son of a Brahmana. She says, not only is he a Brahmana, but he's the son of our military teacher. He's the son of Dronacharya, who taught the Pandavas military warfare. What kind of gratitude would it be for us to kill the son of our military teacher, who's calling my sons out of fight? That wouldn't be very good at all. What kind of gratitude is that? In the Vedic culture, someone who teaches you something, you always consider yourself indebted to them, whether they're teaching you about Krishna or military science or astrology or Sanskrit. You always feel indebted to whoever teaches you something. Just like when I was in India recently, a South Indian Brahmana was teaching me Sanskrit pronunciation. So he told me, I don't take money. The only dakshin, the only gift I ask is that whenever you see me, you speak in Sanskrit. And he meant it sincerely. He was a real Brahmana. He was totally into just teaching. That was his joy. And his reciprocation, he asked for was that when you see me, you just speak in Sanskrit. He was teaching conversational Sanskrit. And then he had a sore throat from teaching so many students. He would just sit by the bank of this lake in Mayapur, a little pond, and devotees would come to him, and he would just, you know, hold forth teaching Sanskrit. That was his thing. In fact, his name was Sanskrit Ananda Hari. And his Ananda, his bliss, was simply teaching Sanskrit all day. And you give him some prasad and a straw mat to sleep on the floor, and he was happy. You know, Sanskrit Ananda Hari. So, he would just say, every teacher requires a reward, not she. Only thing I ask is that when you see me, you speak some Sanskrit words. It makes me very happy. So he had a sore throat. So I gave him like a package of organic licorice that I take. So I gave him a little packet, a sealed package. Cost about $5 much to pay. And so he was so grateful. Oh, yes, he took a few. Oh, this is very good. This is the original Vedic remedy is very nice, very nice. And
that was it.
Yeah. Or like 2 weeks of private instruction. He was just totally satisfied. He had a particular need at the moment, and I solved that need by giving him charity, and that's all he wanted. You know? He wasn't considering, well, you have 20 more for the future. That's what we would think, you know. Right now I have a sore throat, and right now this has appeared. Box, finished, box. Now, Draupadi, she's showing that consideration to the son of her, of the teacher of military science who taught her boys how to fight. She's saying, how can we now kill his son, even though he's done such a dastardly thing, such a horrible thing? How do you think like this in such a crunch situation? That's what you're supposed to wonder when you read Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. How is it that Arjuna is hesitating to fight? That you can understand. No one wants to fight, okay? But here you have Draupadi facing the murder of her 5 babies in their sleep, and she's shown such restraint. She's thinking about society. She's thinking about the teacher of military science who taught her sons. How can he kill his son? What else does she say? And then she gets personal. Before that, she says, this murder, his family is very glorious. How can we kill him when he's from such a glorious family? That's not the sentiment. In other words, she's identifying glorious families as the foundation of society. This is a concept we don't know today. In fact, you've thrown it out because no one wants the old kind of British sense of nobility and royalty to come back in. There are certain families in Vedic culture which were famous for propagating high-quality children. They were famous for establishing generation after generation of noble characters. And that really composed society and made society a very dignified place. Nowadays, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah. No one has the understanding that the family is meant to instill and preserve magnanimity, high virtue. No one has that understanding. It never doesn't matter whether you're a Jackson or a Todd or a this or a that, you know. If you got money, it matters. That's all. But in terms of a family, do you know any families in Christchurch famous for generation after generation of integrity, virtue, noble quality? No. All you'll find maybe is sometimes mentioned in the newspapers of families that are wealthy generation after generation. Everybody admires that. But the Vedic standard is different. Families are admired for their qualities that they're able to perpetuate. So Draupadi is saying like that. How can we kill him when his family is so glorious? She's thinking of all these things. Not thinking of herself. He killed my 5 babies in his sleep. Kill him immediately. Why are we still breathing? He should be dead long ago. He should suffer. Just like my children suffer. We would think something like that. But she's going through all these selfless deliberations. And she's face to face with the killer. I mean, you all, especially ladies, you know the love of the mother for her child. Let's speak of 5 children, 5 little babies. So she's face to face with this killer. So, then she gets very personal, she says. Actually, before that, still. She said, actually, his father is dead, but he's living in the son. Therefore, why should we kill the son when his glorious father is still living by virtue of his existence? And then finally, she said, very personally, I don't want the mother of this murderer, if he's killed by us, I don't want her to suffer like I suffered because I lost my son. Why should his mother suffer like I suffered? Such great self-control we have. I'm grieving because my sons were killed. Why should the mother of this guy, even though he's a murderer, grieve if we kill him? What will it do? This is the great character of Draupadi. But we have a problem here. It sounds really cut and dry, doesn't it? And in fact, Yudhisthira and Nakula and Sahadeva and even Krishna appear to agree with Draupadi. Yes, yes, Yudhisthira is Dharmaraj, the son of religion Vrindavan. Draupadi has spoken very nicely. And all the Pandavas, except one, agree. And Krishna, who previously had been saying, kill him, Arjuna, he seemed to agree. But who didn't agree? Bhima. Bhima was ready to wipe him out immediately. So you had a problem. And actually, what was Krishna really thinking? Krishna had said to Arjuna previously, before Draupadi, he made her speak. He said, kill him. Now what's going on? Actually, Krishna was testing Arjuna with a complex situation. Why does Arjuna need to be tested? He doesn't need to be tested, but Krishna wants to display Arjuna's powers of discrimination and ability to find a balance in a tough situation. So therefore, Krishna first said, kill him, to see what, so that Arjuna would show what he would do. Then Draupadi made her speech, and Krishna seemed to agree with her. So Arjuna had a problem. And Krishna was watching Arjuna and smiling. This is a tough one. How are you going to swallow this one? Your wife. You promised your wife you'd kill him and she could take baths standing on his tall head. At the same time, your wife is saying, now don't kill him. And everyone's agreeing. And I said before to kill him. Bhima's saying to kill him. What are you going to do, Arjuna? But Krishna is smiling because he knows Arjuna will find the right solution. You see, according to Shastra, according to Vedic scripture, Ashwatthama should be killed. He's not to be considered a Brahmana. He doesn't have the behavior or qualities of a Brahmana. So Draupadi was being a bit sentimental and saying, he's a Brahmana, we shouldn't kill him. So, also, the aggressive act of killing sleeping children, that has to be reciprocated appropriately regardless of the social status of the murderer. An aggressor has to be receive the proper punishment. So Krishna is reminding Arjuna of all this, but at the same time, there's Draupadi making her plea, no more violence. One killing will rectify another killing. Let's just end it all now, all this violence and counter-violence, and I don't want it. But Arjuna already promised her, I'm going to kill him. Krishna had said, kill him. Bhima said, kill him. What to do? So Krishna smiled at Arjuna, knowing, you can figure this situation out. Arjuna looked at the smile of Krishna and then understood what to do. He was to kill Ashwatthama, the murderer, but not kill him. And how did he do that? As you all know, he cut off the hair and the jewel which was attached to Ashwatthama's hair. He cut it all off, which for a warrior is worse than death. No understanding, you're not fired. Well, big deal. You just, hey, you got out pretty good, Ashwatthama. You just lost your hair and your jewel. Very mean. No, we don't understand the dynamics of real culture, that for a warrior, dishonor is worse than death. Krishna says that in the Gita to Arjuna. Don't think if you don't fight the war, people are going to honor you. No, dishonor you, and for you, that'll be worse than death. For a Kshatriya, the pride, the honor is the everything. That's why the Pandavas couldn't have refused to gamble, even though they lost their life. The honor, no, I will never back away from a challenge. We'll gamble everything, yes. Life, kingdom, anything, we'll gamble. Let's go. That's a Kshatriya spirit. I don't wonder we have some Kshatriyas here. I'll never back down. He's right. Or I'm right, he's wrong. Either he's right, still he's wrong. We could learn a lot from Draupadi. Now, Prabhupada, he comments on Draupadi's soft part of his saying. On the one hand, she's displaying female softness, which is nice, but at the same time, there has to be some discrimination. And on the other hand, Prabhupada says she's actually showing the qualities of a pure devotee. So you have to see all these different levels. Draupadi is a pure devotee of the Lord, but she's also displaying female nature in relation to Krishna's service. So, in Prabhupada's purports, you get to see her feminine side as well as her pure emotional side. You see it, the same situation from different aspects. So, Prabhupada, the purport, points out that it's nice she's being soft-hearted, but actually some discrimination is required because this murderer is unqualified. He cannot be treated as if he's from a glorious family or he's a Brahmana. He's done something abominable and he should get the results. While in a subordinate way, taking into account his circumstances, his family, his social occupation. So it looks like a very difficult situation for Arjuna. And it's a good lesson for us because amongst devotees, there's often very intricate situations to deal with. When the Hare Krishna movement first started, life was very easy. Everybody was like a missionary, on call 24 hours a day, living communally. You know, there were no complications caused by people, most devotees having their own homes, having their jobs, and still trying to do some service. When the Hare Krishna movement first started, most members were young, idealistic, single, and so it was all hands on deck. It was like living in a firehouse. Just when the bell sounded, when the alarm sounded, service to be done, everybody just did it. Things were very homogenous and easy to deal with. You just had a bunch of enthusiastic persons in their 20s, and they didn't have to worry about jobs or home mortgages, this or that. They all, like here in Christ Church, so many lived in this building. So, now things are a bit different. As the Hare Krishna movement has been in the Western world for more than 30 years now, we see many devotees have homes, they have families, they have jobs. At the same time, some persons are picking up Krishna consciousness, they're single, and they have a different view of things than those who have the homes and the jobs and families. And how to accommodate all this? I was recently talking with Mukunda Maharaj about the publication, this time World Review. So he was saying that, it's really full of a lot of things about women and children these days, and that's all right, but we need some more of some preaching impact. So we were discussing that the editors of this publication, they're living in Florida in kind of suburban circumstances. They have their own homes, their jobs, they do the publication, they're part-time. And naturally, the publication will reflect where they're at. So we both commented, this is a legitimate view they have. They're living in Krishna conscious suburbia, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they're absorbed in homes and children and husband-wife relationship. So that's a legitimate view of what should be important in Krishna consciousness. But there's a problem. That's not the only thing that's important. There has to be other things too. So the question is how all these things can be accommodated. It's not a question of this or that. It's now a question of this and that. So how to hit the mark? Just like how is Arjuna going to hit the mark about killing Ashwatthama and not killing him? Otherwise, as I was discussing with Janakiyas yesterday, things can kind of degenerate in temples to the pure devotee syndrome on one extreme, to call it a sardonic way, and the wishy-washy syndrome on the other extreme, to use a sardonic word. You've got those who say, surrender completely, that's the purpose of the temple. And then on the other extreme, you've got those who just back off and let us live our lives and, pay up your mortgages yourself and see what it's like. Bring up your teenagers, your son will change. So how to handle both of these things? Both are legitimate views. This is the problem. It's not like, right or wrong. These guys are off and we're on. And when things assume that kind of aura, it's not nice. We've got to keep both views respectful of one another and acknowledging that both are viable world views. Just like Arjuna. He saw Krishna smile, and Arjuna knew, I've got to balance both these things. Draupadi's compassion and soft-heartedness, And the Shastra, which actually said, the scriptures say, he should be killed. What to do? Difficult situation. So Krishna was smiling, seeing Arjuna perform in this difficult circumstance. How is Arjuna going to hit the mark and balance this very, incredible situation? And remember, Arjuna, he's dealing with the murder of his son, Draupadi's his wife. And he's got to think clearly in this kind of situation, after just apprehending the culprit, after a huge battle with the culprit and finally apprehending him, now Arjuna has to think clearly and calmly. Very difficult. But Krishna knows, my pure devotee can handle this. And so Krishna let Arjuna display his extraordinary personal qualities. So that's the only solution to our daily commotions we sometimes go through. We've got to agree to display some abnormal personal qualities. It's a very difficult thing to step out of the way you see things and try to see it from someone else's point of view. Very difficult. But it shows great sense control. It's very educational and very purifying. And that is, that builds character. It builds detachment when you can see that, well, it's not the way I would do things, but it's a viable way of approaching things. Ooh. Recently, I gave some devotees a little small book describing four basic personality types with a short personality test in the front. Very famous book, because it's short, doesn't entangle your mind in reading it, and it has a very active personality test. And they were astonished to realize that there can be personalities. Each one was astonished to realize that there could be a different type of personality than mine. Amazing. The four basic material personality types, like the leadership style, my way or the highway. Then the passive style, whatever, just go with the flow. Then the analytical style, always analyzing things and seeing complexity and everything. And then the people's person, the people lover, the party person who just easily just, enthuses everyone and, without even thinking what he or she is saying, just gushes, the life of the party types. These are four basic personality types. So these devotees, this is in Wellington, they were astonished. It could be a personality not like me and you and be and a viable one of that. You mean people actually see the world that way? You see, for example, for the analytical type, it's called a perfect melancholy. The party, the life of the party type is just incomprehensible. Somebody just says whatever, is needed to just give everybody a laugh and everything's needed to be allowed. The kind everybody likes to have is social events. But these types, when it comes to, the details of life, they're horrible. And the perfect melancholy, the analytical types, when it comes to the details of life, they excel. But they're party movers. They are in ecstasy when they're looking very miserable and being absorbed and analyzed in some situation. They're actually in ecstasy. I could give an example of someone who's no longer here, who was exactly like that, and who recognized it completely. But you remember Chandrasekhar's one? He took the test, and he's totally a perfect melancholy. Sometimes he would look like so downcast, but actually he was in ecstasy, analyzing very minutely some financial situation, or whether the car should have orange mats on the floor or black mats on the floor. He would spend days on it, and he would look like he was really gloomy about it. Actually, he was really inner ecstasy. So that's a type of personality, and it's a great achievement for us to understand that somebody can see things completely different from me and respond to life completely different from me. How can that be? It really takes sense control and development of high qualities to get to this point, and that's the direction we have to go in. Otherwise, we're always, my way is obvious. And then we gather around us people who feel the same way. Yes, your way is obvious. Things aren't going to go on like that. We have to learn to follow Arjuna's footsteps and deal with what often are big complex situations and see the value and the sincerity in everyone. even though they don't do things your way.
It's a really great achievement.
Well, he or she doesn't do it my way, but I guess even still, though, their way has some value. That's a great achievement. And this is what's needed right now, because no longer are we just a youthful assembly of persons who are just all living single lives and all doing missionary work. And it's like, you know, like in a firehouse. A firehouse has a very unified culture. The alarm sounds. And I know because in Wellington, the working men may have a plaque right behind the Wellington fire station. So I park there in my bus. I can see what's going on in the fire station. It's all very coordinated and unified. Everyone knows their purpose. I'm a fireman. When the alarm sounds, you know, you can hear the loudspeaker. You know, corner of Dixon and such and such street, such and such high fire, and the firemen just run out and jump into their, you know, their trucks and take off. And it's Hare Krishna used to be like that, believe it or not. And that's still what the people think is Hare Krishna today. Well, that went out many decades ago because, you know, our loose lips sink ships. What's the ship that sinks? Our spiritual intelligence. You have to be very careful about that. How can we change any tradition of immature dealing? That's what we should be thinking at. All right, what's done is done, but how can we change that? How can we toss that tradition out if it's there? How do we get rid of this culture of immature dealings? Where if someone disagrees with us, immediately we try to belittle them or saw the floor out from under them. No, we don't want to do that. We want to learn to see from someone else's point of view. And that requires sense control. And through that effort of developing that kind of sense control, we'll develop wonderful qualities, just like we see the qualities displayed with Arjuna and Yudhisthira and Draupadi. There are examples. Now, of course, they're extraordinary examples, but still, they are our examples. Let us meditate on it. Arjuna's difficult situation. And use that as a restraint upon ourselves to not get high on the horse and get high and mighty. I see it exactly the way it is. We know what's right. That person, yeah. We don't want to do that at all. We want to have the restraint of Draupadi when facing the murder of her five sleeping children. She was looking for the good. And then Arjuna had to actually take into account Draupadi's feelings, he had to take into account Bhima's feelings, Krishna's feelings. He had to come to a conclusion that would handle all of that. It can't be done unless we have proper dealings between devotees, proper appreciation of devotees. When you appreciate someone, it's easy to begin to see things from their point of view. But as soon as we resort to slashing each other, belittling each other, you know, propagandizing against one another, then we don't get the intelligence from Krishna how to handle Krishna's affairs. In fact, we lose sight that these are Krishna's affairs, and we get caught up in personality battles and grudges and grievances as we've been discussing the past few days. So if we can all somehow resolve to curb our tongues, this is austerity of speech as explained by Krishna in the Gita, anudvegam prayam vakyam, satyam priyatam chaya. You speak favorably. Speak that which is true. Don't speak words that agitate. These are all qualities given by Krishna for a proper tongue. Loose lips sink ships. I'm sure almost all our devotees understand the power of the tongue, how someone has been mortally wounded, how a devotee has been mortally wounded because of our loose tongue. I've seen cases in which devotees actually cry because of the effect of loose tongues. Oh, that's horrible. We don't want that to happen. We don't want to cause any devotee pain because of our loose tongue or our conniving tongue. Let me see what I can say about this person to put them in their place and make everyone realize what I realize that person's a nonsense. Let me see what I can say. conniving of. Loose tongue means just letting things roll off your tongue without considering the consequences. So when there are loose tongues or conniving tongues, there is pain amongst the Vaishnavas. And we don't want to be responsible for that pain. I should have brought it with me, but those of you who are aware of various talks, you know, that bubble around the world sometimes, you know, we just had the so-called poisoning thing. And it's amazing how that was built on such loose talk and speculation and became so offensive. So-called poisoning problem. So, I had to write the introduction for a book refuting the whole nonsense, and I basically pointed out the role of offending Vaishnavas, what happens when we do not properly honor the Lord's devotees, how we develop an offensive mentality. So, it's a perfect example of that. Just by ill motives and loose tongues, massive offenses start accumulating into a complete fantasy which just suits someone's ill motives. Horrible. All from loose tongues and ill motives. So we should put an end to any culture or any tradition of immature dealings between devotees. And we're going to have to work hard to satisfy both elements. The family maintenance element and the missionary element. Both are necessary. There's no doubt about it. We are servants of Nityai Gaurachandra. What is their job? To spread Krishna consciousness everywhere. Wherever you go, wherever you meet, teach them the science of Krishna. That's our inheritance. There's nothing we can do about that. But naturally, after people receive knowledge of Krishna, what are they going to do? They're all not going to become lifelong missionaries. They're going to want to have a home and raise kids. So that has to be there also. So all these things have to be taken together. Why do we talk so much about missionary work? Because this is Lord Chaitanya's mission. What can we do? We cannot give that up. We cannot back away from that stress. At the same time, once you be a missionary to someone, they're going to live somewhere. They're going to marry, have kids. What do you do then? Just abandon them? So all these things have to be considered together. And that takes very fine consciousness. Fine consciousness means free from immature dealings amongst devotees. Any questions? So,
throughout the Islamic world these days, these elements are there, and they have to be dealt with in a very balanced way. You're having a widespread congregational participation. At the same time, there has to be room for concentrated missionary activities by those who are inclined to do that. And you have so many elements to balance. You've got the ascending and descending process. You've got the vox populi. The people feel this. The congregation feels this. And then you've got to take into account. But the management and the leaders feel that. So it can't all be one way. How to balance all this? It's going to require some sense control. How to keep all this together? And that sense control and liberation won't happen in an atmosphere of immature dealings between devotees. Let me see what I can, what attack I can call down upon you. Let me see what hot water I can put you in. Let's see how to see this situation negatively. Let's overlook this first, this devotee's good motives, and let's see all the bad things. Aha! I saw something! You don't want that. Or the grievances. If you want to become dear to the deity, you've got to do something about grievances. Fuse boiling and simmering for the past, day of Brahma. We've got to do something about that. It's hard also, but Krishna will like it if you try to do something about it. And you may not immediately be successful in your eyes, but just the fact that you try pleases Krishna. We can't give up. That's the worst thing. I tried talking to that person. I'm sure you are. We get it, 5 years ago, she did this and that. That's just the way. No. Try and try again. Why? To please Krishna. All we got, all you have is yourselves here. Some of you have been here, 25 years or something like that, 15 years, whatever, long time. Then either A or B has to try to cross that bridge. B keeps trying. Or who's A? Who's willing? A is willing. A keeps trying. Nah, I try and just see. Being reciprocated. That shows that. No. You keep trying. And then you can do another tactic. A wants, B doesn't want, so maybe you have to bring in C. We use our intelligence. And maybe C can prevail upon B to deal with A, and maybe C convinces A that actually you're not really trying in the best way. Which will be news to A. So, this way that way, when there's a sincere desire, things start to happen. Right. No, you cannot give up. When you're dealing with devotees who are sincere, you cannot give up. And the devotees here are sincere. But sometimes we all become trapped in habitual patterns. Especially in isolated areas comparatively where there's not a lot of movement going other places. And there's not an influx of people from other places and an exit of people going to other places. Then you really gotta learn how to deal with each other and appreciate one another, because you is all you've got. And that will inspire new people. But, just like these new persons here across. She's not a fool. She knows human beings, even the best ones, sometimes have a go at one another sometimes, right? But you'll be satisfied to see there's an effort made to minimize her deal with that's all. You're not a starry-eyed utopia, right? So that's what the people want to see. You're making a very exemplary effort. But what they don't want to see is they read these glorious books and they come and see, very uninspiring behavior. That's what they don't want. It's inspiring to see a sincere effort being made. And then? Yes. Yes, we. You have to attribute good motives to devotees. Give them credit for having some sincerity, even though they may not greet you in the morning. Of course, it'd be nice that they greet you in the morning, but sometimes, you know, they're worried about things. How to control my senses, or, how will I pay the rent for my family next week? Or sometimes they got things on their mind, you know. I'm not satisfying some devotees what to do. Well, you have to understand that. And be merciful. Mercy means to try to see something from someone else's point of view and give them credit for having some good quality. We need to develop a culture of self-restraint in dealing with devotees. Remember, loose lips sink ships. I know you all have experience of feeling pain because of someone's loose tongue. I know you all have an experience. Amongst devotees, this is very deadly. Krishna doesn't like it. It's hard enough trying to preach Krishna consciousness in this savage age. You don't want to make it harder. You don't want to make things harder than they actually are. And devotees are glorious and wonderful. They're trying to sacrifice. Let us try to see that more and more. Your sacrifice may not be the way I think it should be done, but you're trying to sacrifice. I want to see that. And let us bear in mind, we have our obligation to Lord Chaitanya, we have our obligation to Srila Prabhupada. Certain things have to go on as our cultural inheritance from Lord Chaitanya. It'd be easy to ignore family development, say, forget it, we're just doing missionary activities. And it'd be easier to ignore the missionary activities and say, we're just doing family development. But we've got to hit the mark and deal with both. But bear in mind, if there is going to be a slant, that sooner or later, those in family affairs at the end of their life are supposed to absorb themselves in missionary affairs. So there is a bit of a bias, and that we can't deny. But that bias can't become oppressive. Those people may never preach, they don't care about preaching. That may very well be true. But at the end of their life, they're supposed to care. And when those who are preaching become proud, I'm a preacher. After all, Krishna takes your potency away. Pride finishes everything. Actually, Prabhupada instructs that you never think of yourself as a preacher. Preachers, Prabhupada, the preachers I think. I'm not a preacher. I'm the servant of the preacher. Preacher, that's too high. Preacher, Lord Chaitanya, such a high position. I'm just a menial servant.